Hej och välkomna till Udda Ting, en podcast om sällsamma historier, kreativitet och kreatörerna själva. Mitt namn är Henrik Möller, musiken var skapad av Testbild och loggan till podden är gjord av Malmökonstnären Nalle Chinsky. Det här avsnittet ska handla om ghouls. Första gången som jag stötte på namnet var i Lovecrafts noveller som Pikmin's Model och Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, där de presenterades som en människoliknande varelse med ett hundhuvud som hänger på kyrkogårdar och äter lik. Lite senare så stötte jag på varelsen i en av Lovecrafts förebilder, William Beckfords roman Vatek. Men tydligen så kommer namnet från förislamsk mytologi, där det helt enkelt benämns som en ond humanoid varelse. Men jag ska inte prata så mycket nu, utan jag ska lämna över till experten Kenneth Haidt och Lovecraft-forskaren Will Murray med flera i en panel inspelad under Necronomicon 2022 i Providence, och den handlade ju såklart om just ghouls. Ljudkvaliteten är lite sådär, så att jag har gjort mitt bästa, men skruva gärna upp volymen till och från om ni tycker att det hörs lite tyst. Varsågoda.
The Galu is a being that appears in Mesopotamian mythology, and I think I've tracked down the reference, but I think that this being is just similar to ghoul in terms of the name. When I've actually looked in some of the material about it, it's a Galuism word that means constable. So it can be a human constable, or it can be a spirit acting as a constable, and it will show up sometimes in incantations that way, because Mesopotamians sometimes weren't sure about where illness would come from or misfortune. And so what they would do is they'd have these incantations where they just list everything. You know, it's like, okay, it could be a witch, it could be, you know, one of these spirits, it could be one of these spirits, it could be the Uduk, it could be the Galu, and they just go on down. So what I think is correct about this is that it places it in this category of beings, which is kind of occupies, turns up in a lot of Fertile Crescent mythologies, where you have these beings, unknown beings, which are very nonspecific about what they are and what they do, off on the edge of civilization, off in the wilderness, and they're just generally considered bad news, and you want to avoid them as much as possible. And I think this is sort of the mythological background from which the Bedouin ghoul emerges. That particular ghoul turns up first in the 6th century, so this is pre-Islam. It is, I tend to think of them in terms of fairies, which is going to throw everybody for a loop, but I'm thinking more about this in a traditional sense. So you've got this type of being that's sort of a human, but sort of not, that lives off on the edge of things. They tend to lead travelers astray. They're very good with illusions. In fact, some of the Arabic sources say that the key component of a ghoul is the illusion. And they are often viewed as malevolent. They will, mislead people and bring them out to the edge of civilization and, inflict madness on them and, likely eat them. But they can also be helpful. There is the possibility even of humans marrying ghouls because they've been sort of assimilated back into civilization. There are also a few, little weird twists there, one of which is that after Islam comes about, one common motif is the conversion of ghouls. It's like, okay, so we go out there and you have a philosophical conversation with the ghoul while it's trying to eat you, and it's like, I can see where you're coming from. The other piece that you see a lot more of is folk tales about swordplay. So, people going out and actually getting in fights with the ghoul, and one of its properties is sometimes that if you hit it once, you can kill it. But if you have to hit it a second time, or if you hit it a second time after you've already killed it with the first hit, it will come back, and you can't kill it with 1,000 more hits. So there's sometimes these tales of somebody strikes the ghoul heavily. It's like, oh no, please finish me off. And then they get a voice. Someone else present says, no, don't do that because the ghoul will come back to life. And wacky ghouls, just die now. And It's also the element of illusion, as I said, because they can change their appearances. They often have some sort of animal aspect to them, often something like a donkey. Sometimes they have cat eyes, and they can shift their appearances rapidly. They are generally considered, unless you can actually convert them or convince them that they help you, they are some of the dangers of the desert. So I think that summarizes a lot of the lore about them, but one thing you'll notice I have not brought up at all is anything about graveyards or eating the dead. So I think we can pick up from there.
The person who seems to have introduced graveyards and eating the dead into the lore of the ghoul was a guy named Antoine Galland. He was a French scholar. He was a genuine scholar. He read Turkish, he read Persian, he read Syrian. He was, not a, armchair guy at all. He traveled throughout the Ottoman Empire, and he came back with a book that was called A Thousand Nights and a Night, and he thought, what a great book. I'm going to translate it into French. And by translate, I mean rewrite it into French, because, it's primitive folktales, and sophisticated money-having consumers want a fancier folktale. So he writes the book that we now know as The Arabian Nights. He's the guy who gives it the name, The Arabian Nights. And some of the nights come from a manuscript of Syrian tales that he had that you can see in libraries now, we think. We're not 1,000,000% sure it's the same manuscript as the first story. But some of them are known as orphan tales, which probably does not mean Galland made them entirely up, but does mean he collected them from storytellers in Turkey, or storytellers in Egypt, or storytellers in different parts of the East when he was traveling around, and then he would remember those stories. Whether or not he took notes at the time, we do not know. But he would remember the stories, and he would write them down and add them to his cool Arabian Nights, because he wants to make it 1,000 nights, so that he makes word count. An impulse known to all of us. And among the stories that he adds in the orphan stories is a story called The Tale of Sidi Numan, which is about a man who marries a ghoul. It is a very similar to sort of French fairy tales, in that you marry a fairy or a swan maid or a werewolf or whatever, and she says, don't look in my bedroom, don't watch me bathe, don't follow me when I leave the house. In this case, the ghoul, whose name is Amina, only eats rice, one grain at a time, at meals. And she says, I'm very delicate. I'm a beautiful feminine flower. I can't be gorging myself like a man. And don't follow me when I leave the house. And Sidi Numan, a suspicious fellow, follows her when she leaves the house. And sure enough, she goes back to a graveyard with her ghoul babies and eats corpses. And that's why she's always full and can only bear to eat rice when she's with Sidi Numan. And that's a horrible, startling revelation. And that's the end of the story, basically. Galland's ghouls, I don't want to say they take Europe by storm, but they begin to sort of filter into dictionaries of Islam. People start mentioning ghouls. Other sorts of stories use the word ghoul. They don't usually center on ghouls. And then a fellow named William Beckford writes a Gothic novel called Vathek, which is about a historical caliph named Vathek, who did none of the things that Beckford says. Basically, the caliph has so much power that he says, I'm bored, I'm going to summon Iblis, the devil, and he's going to give me cool stuff to do. And among the cool stuff that he does is he has little adventures with ghouls, and Beckford makes sure to mention their sort of charnel nature. And helpfully, he writes it in French. The guy who translates it against his will into English is a guy named Samuel Henley, who puts in a lot of notes. And among the notes to Beckford's Vathek is, for example, Al-Azif, the sound of the sound of insects at night, often ascribed to demons. And Lovecraft has read that entry, as we all know. And one of his other entries is helpfully explaining ghouls. He says, ghouls are ogres that lurk in waste places. They lure you off the road and eat you. Sometimes they can take the form of beautiful women. And everyone's like, okay, I got it. And they also, if they can't get travelers, they'll go to the graveyard and eat all the dead bodies. And that's where Beckford's ghoul enters, and I believe one of the Henley notes later, or one of the bits of poetry in the novel, discusses the ghoul and uses the word something like wolf-like scalp to describe the ghoul. So that's the first of the Lovecraftian dog head motifs that comes in. There's a fellow named Alfred North Whitehead who writes a terrific short story called Amina, which is basically a retelling in modern dress of the tale of Sidi Numan. And of course, Clark Ashton Smith wrote a terrific ghoul story, in addition to the Grinning Ghoul, which is a different ghoul story, The Nameless Offspring, which is about a man who has basically traveled to the East and contracted a perhaps unwise marriage. And the offspring of that marriage is trapped beneath the house. And of course, the people who come to visit the man pick the bad day, and the ghoulish offspring gets out and runs away, and that's the end. But you can see, even as late as Clark Ashton Smith's early writing, we have still the ghoul seen as a Persian monster or Whitehead's story takes place in Persia, or a monster that is imported from the East to the West, a la Dracula. Dracula is scary not just because he's a vampire, but because he's a foreigner. He's from Transylvania. We can't have people like that, you know, marrying English people. That would be wrong. So the otherization, the orientalization, the exoticization of the ghoul is very much part of that ghoul story. And again, it shows up even post-Lovecraft. L. Ron Hubbard writes a ghoul story in which the ghoul is also a genie who transforms. And that does, in fact, go back to Mesopotamian folklore, or rather, Bedouin folklore. So that ghoul would seem to have been the, you know, unbreakable model of the ghoul forever, that it's just another exotic monster, until H.P. Lovecraft changed it up. And to deal with that, we have Will Murray to talk about Lovecraft's ghoul.
Lovecraft, when he was very young, went through what we could call his Arabian period, where he read The Thousand and One Nights and fell in love with the culture as he perceived it. And of course, that's where he probably came first in contact with the concept of the ghoul. And during that time, he named himself fancifully Abdul Al-Hazred, which, you know, doesn't translate well, but you didn't know that at the time. So he had this immersion in the Middle Eastern cultures as they were transmitted through the books being described. I don't know when he read Vathek. I assume it was much later.
Yeah, it was. I think it was in the 20s.
Yeah, I would think so. So when he starts to write more seriously, he gets out of his juvenilia 100 years ago, approximately at this time, 1920, 21, 22, 23. He starts to bring the ghoul into his stories. And first he does it sort of by the back door. We all know that Pickman's Model is probably his big ghoul story. But before that, a year or two before that, he writes The Outsider. A very O-esque story about a narrator who stumbles out of some underground catacomb in an unknown place that, certainly from the style of writing, you would think it would be England or Europe. And he finds a castle and people, and he steps in and tries to introduce himself, and everybody flees in terror. And he doesn't know who he is, how he got there, only he's been alive a long time, and he lived underground. Now he's above ground, and when he encounters a mirror, he sees why everybody fled. He's essentially a corpse, or seems to be a corpse. However, the story at the end veers very sharply in another direction. And if I have that page at hand, he basically starts talking about now he rides the winds with the ghouls in what is obviously Egypt. So I guess maybe he's a mummy. I don't know. But it's never described. And that's the first time Lovecraft uses ghouls in his fiction. And it's only a few years later that he writes Pickman's Model, in which, again, I don't want to recount the entire story. I assume just about everybody here has read it once. And so you may be able to recite it from memory. But about it's about a painter named Hen Pickman, who lives in the north end of Boston. And he's a painter of unusual subjects, and a lot of his subjects are creatures who feed and cavort in graveyards. And the narrator ultimately discovers that Pickman is not what he seems. He's what Lovecraft sort of presents as a ghoul changeling, someone outwardly human but has ghoul qualities. And Lovecraft's ghouls are like, a little bit like the Vathek ghouls, in that they have a canine aspect, but they're rubbery like the night gaunts that used to haunt, you know, Lovecraft's nightmares, more or less during or around the time of his Arabian period. They're slumpy, slouchy creatures. They feed upon the corpses. And it's implied in the story they either kidnap babies and transform them or train them to be ghouls, or they swap babies. Actually, I don't remember.
It's kind of both are implied.
Yeah, it's unclear. So Lovecraft is taking, as he often did with mythological creatures, he's abstracted them from their original, you know, locality, Arabia, transporting it to Egypt in one story, at the north end of Boston in another story, and making it his own, giving it a canine aspect to the face, and making them these creatures who can only be seen in graveyards, can only feed upon the dead, and live underground, like the outsider, but the outsider isn't a ghoul, as nearly we tell, he's just somehow related to the ghouls or becomes friendly with the ghouls because they're all tomb creatures, so to speak, underground creatures. What's interesting is I did research on the north end and I found the alley where Pickman's, he's back in the 80s, where Pickman's, you know, studio would have been in. The older buildings have been torn down. The alley is still there. And I went to Copp's Hill Burying Ground where the ghouls were cavorting and discovered through research, but also finding an open tomb there, that some of the tombs are false. And during revolutionary or pre-revolutionary times, colonists would build smuggling tunnels to the water. Copp's Hill Burying Ground is, you know, on Little Hill. It's very close to the water. And they occasionally you'll find the waterside opening of one of these smuggling tunnels. And this is where the ghouls were moving, you know. Unsuspected by the people who lived above. And the north end of Boston happens to be the oldest inhabited part of Boston. It was originally the colonials, and then it became, for a long time, it was a black area, then an Italian area, and then it became a yuppie area. Now it's more like, you know, generally, whoever lives there, although it still has an Italian flavor. But it's the feeding ground of Lovecraft schools. And of course, as some of you know, Lovecraft revisited Richard Pickman in Dream Quest of the Unknown Caedith, where he seemed to revisit a lot of things in a kind of a dreamlike catch-as-catch-can kind of way. And in the dreamland, when the narrator, Carter, why am I not remembering the first names today?
Randolph.
Of course, it's a Dream Quest of Unknown Caedith, and Randolph Carter was in another story too. During his journey, Randolph Carter comes upon Richard Pickman, and he's basically a ghoul now, and he's cavorting with ghouls. But these ghouls are—you can talk to them. If you know how to beep and gibber and whatever, you can communicate with them, and they help him move from here to there until he meets Nyarlathotep, who is attended by a character named Yogash the Black, who seems to be the same as Yogash the Ghoul in one of Lovecraft's fanciful genealogies of Clark Ashton Smith. Yogash the Ghoul in the genealogy was the descendant of Cthulhu, which seems a little weird since Cthulhu is a non-terrestrial, non-physical being, and Yogash the Ghoul would presumably be a ghoul. And maybe he's a super ghoul. I don't know. When I was first made aware that I was on this panel, I asked myself, do I know enough about ghouls? And I almost begged off this panel until a memory came back after 2 weeks. Did I write about this subject once? And happily, there are World Army bibliographies online that people have taken upon themselves to do, and I looked up my list of articles than I saw on grad school days. Published in Crypto Cthulhu in 1983.
How does he know so much about ghouls?
So I fortunately was able to dig up a copy and copy it, and I reread it with great amazement. I didn't know I knew this much about ghouls, Lovecraftian ghouls. And one of the things I came up with, which I may have been the first to do, is since the first ghouls in Lovecraft were not Arabian but Egyptian, it got me to thinking, is there some Egyptian connection to Lovecraft's ghouls? And then I hit upon Anubis, the jackal-headed god of death. And in Egyptian culture, the jackal liked to prowl, the tombs and places. That's where they would be most seen. And the dog and the jackal are both canines. And I realized that what Lovecraft may have done with his ghouls, in part by, because of the clue of the Egyptian ghouls, was somehow they were connected to Anubis, even though in subsequent stories they seem more connected to Nyarlathotep, but not quite as directly as we might like to have a complete understanding of it. So I think the ghouls are kind of Anubis, spawn, just as there are Cthulhu spawn. And Lovecraft did not do much with the ghouls beyond Pickman's model, The Outsider, and Dreamquest, but he certainly, during the 1920s, they were pretty central to his concept of, creatures that were interesting to write about that he could make sort of his own. I hadn't known until you said it that the Vathek ghouls were canine.
They're not explicitly canine, but it's in the poem. The description is they have a head like a cat. So, but they have the scalp of a dog. So,
okay.
Whatever that means, it's messed up.
I find it interesting that they're rubbery like the night gods.
Yeah, I think that's just a go-to Lovecraft adjective.
That might be.
Let's talk a little bit about definitions. People who've been listening to panels with me know that I'm not a big fan of bright line definitions that I define from the beginning or from the middle. So you take the things everyone agrees on about ghouls, and that's ghouls, and then it doesn't matter where you draw the line because you can draw it anyway. But let's talk about lines and boundaries. I'd like to get everyone's take on what you think is sort of the core feature of ghoulness, the characteristics of the ghoul. Is it graves? Is it necrophagy? Is it the canine features? Is it having changelings? Where does the line exist, or should it exist, between the Romero zombie and the Renfield and the Chud and the Ed Gein, cannibal killer? All of those are clearly connected to ghoulness somehow, and certainly vampire sidekick Renfields are called ghouls in about half of vampire literature. And do we need to stop for that synonym, or is that part of ghoulosity? What do people think?
I will say that to me, a ghoul is something that gravitates towards anything that's dead, whether it's a necropolis or a tomb or a pile of corpses. I assume if we have a battlefield situation and a lot of corpses lying around at night, ghouls might come out to feed. Mm-hmm. So it's basically anywhere that is a locus point for rotting corpses or corpses awaiting rotting, awaiting putrefaction. So to me, it's the deadness, the fact that they exist in the ecology, if we could call it that, of the Lovecraftian world or the greater horror world, is they're like the flies that consume whatever lay their eggs, and the ghouls are the eaters of the dead. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's their core. And everything else, like the canine stuff, that was an accretion at a later time that they acquired through, writers who liked to go in that direction. Mm-hmm. But also that comes from, to me, the Anubis kind of thing, that, a jackal is a feaster of corpses, and therefore they represent a final resolution to the problem of a dead body.
I have to agree partially and build on that. I think that a fascination and dependence and connection with the dead, for me, is that absolutely necessary for a ghoul, for that definition of ghoul. Whether you're a human being who's obsessed with the dead in a very unhealthy way, either eating or copulating or whatever, or even just propping them up at the table, propping mom up in a chair upstairs.
So Norman Bates.
Norman Bates is a ghoul. You know, it could be that natural creature waiting, to get into the graveyard. It could be Renfield, because Renfield is fascinated by the dead. Dracula is dead. He is a servant of the dead. And let's say he doesn't die. Let's say Renfield, moves on. Is Dracula going to make this guy a vampire? No, he's worthless. Is this guy going to evolve into something less than human? I would say so. I would say that Renfield is a budding ghoul of that school of thought of corruption and transformation into something essentially non-human.
Right. So when they take Renfield's body out of the asylum and they throw it in wherever, and he sits up,
he's,
3 days later,
yeah,
and he's like,
yeah.
I'm so hungry.
He'll be clawing. Renfield would be clawing his way out of that coffin and finding a bunch of other ghouls.
Free sequel idea.
Right. Are Romero's zombies ghouls? An argument could be made. I would be on the other side of that argument, because while it is a corruption, it's almost like a viral corruption or a curse. If you're going to get to the zombie mythology.
And also, famously, they eat the living.
And they eat the living. They're not eating each other.
Right.
And I'm of the school of thought that ghouls are not undead. They are living creatures. But that's, again, my favorite interpretation. And I guess that's what we're really talking about, our interpretation.
Well, yeah. I mean, we sadly don't have Samuel Henley here to annotate authoritatively what ghouls are. Daniel, you're our Samuel Henley. Annotate authoritatively what ghouls are.
Okay, I'm going to go with the folkloric answer. The key defining trait of ghouls is shape-shifting, because that's simultaneously correct and completely wrong for this panel.
All of my questions were about that, because I love fae folklore too, and I'm like, we'll have a drink.
I should also point out that this is a motif that does come back. I think it was Brian McDonald's, the late Brian McDonald's Throne of Bones that brought this back. The idea of both the ghouls as shapeshifters, but they can take on the forms of the people they eat.
Yeah.
So
they get the memories too.
I think they get the memories too.
Yeah.
Damn. Stand that shit out.
Delta Green at least.
Yeah.
But you can steal it too. You can steal it from them. It's steal whatever you want.
Yeah, McNaughton's Throne of Bones, obviously, probably the post-Lovecraftian classic ghoul fantasy novel. I would throw out Caitlin Kiernan's Ghoul Cycle, basically. I forget the name. One of them is The Red Tree, but she's got, I think...
Daughter of Hounds. Yeah.
There's a number of novels and short stories. They're all worth reading, and they center on the ecology that we've talked about, but also the social ecology. The people who grow up into this sort of weird family criminal life of robbing the dead's belongings and also feeding them to ghouls and sometimes being recruited or married into the ghoul lineages. And there's a sort of a sympathy for the ghoul in the same way that The Godfather is sympathy for the mob, bit to it, and it's terrific. And so I would say, for me, the core element of the ghoul is the interface with humanity in that way, through the lens of the dead, certainly. But
may I be so bold as to throw a question?
Sure.
The Addams Family, ghouls or not ghouls?
I would say strong case could be made. We do not ever see them canonically eat a dead person.
You do see them digging them up.
Yes, exactly. lots of people dig up dead people. But obviously, something keeps Morticia's skin so pearly and beautiful and white. I think eating the dead could be in it. Right, could be the shape changing. She just ate Angelica Houston, and that was it. I threw that out mostly to talk about the fact that the ghoul is plastic, it shapeshifts, as Dan says, and so we can take Norman Bates as a ghoul, we can take Romero zombies as ghouls if we want. And Norman Bates, of course, is a fictionalization of Ed Gein, who is a life, a legitimate example of a human ghoul in the sense of someone who is obsessed with death and, you know, focused on it, perhaps, to the exclusion of everything else. I guess this is where you put a footnote and say that the Werewolf of Paris, the novel by Guy Endor, is actually about a ghoul, so take that, werewolves. And that also might be where Lovecraft gets the notion of a canine ghoul from, because if he's read Werewolf of Paris, he thinks, well, that's just a ghoul, but he's a werewolf. Is there a, in his subconscious, might have been turning that over along with the jackal and along with the notes in Henley. I feel like I had a lovely question about George Wetzel's theory that the ghoul changeling is a central motif in Lovecraft, but I think like Will Murray basically already answered that question, and no one else is going to do as well, so I will spare us all the embarrassment and say, what's your favorite incarnation of the ghoul, like specifically? What's your favorite ghoul story or scenario or campaign book or... give us a recommended reading list, a couple of titles or one title, everybody.
Well, Pickman's Model.
Well, yeah. I meant besides that.
You know, I don't know that I read much besides that I would call a cool story. I mean, I read, you know, actually now that I think of it, Robert Johnson's Far Below, which is a famous weird tale story that was about ghouls inhabiting subway tunnels. I don't remember it clearly enough to talk about it, but it was very popular at the time, much reprinted in later decades.
And it's superb, it's well worth hunting down.
And you know, he took, I imagine he took the Lovecraftian ghoul idea of they're under our cities and brought it to another level by having it, you know, essentially feed off of subway riders.
It's literally a riff on the painting Subway Accident from Pickman's Model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so that's my favorite Lovecraftian ghouls.
That's from 1939. Robert Johnson.
Far below. Far below.
And the author one
more
time,
please.
Robert Barber Johnson. We're not going to do this for all the authors. You guys have just got to be better at keeping notes. I think we have to mention the Peter Cushing. Was it Peter Cushing movie, The Ghoul, Hammer, or Amicus? One of those.
That's right.
Yes, and it's once more. This is the Orientalist ghoul. This is the, you know, well, he spent time in India. Obviously, his son's going to be a ghoul. That just happens. But it's a fairly effective. A movie, it, you know, it's called The Ghoul. Who doesn't love that? And it features some pretty good acting, and it gives you sort of flavor and flair for that. I also want to mention there's a Gene Wolfe ghoul story that has a explicitly Egyptian connection, and I want to say it's War of the Land. And in fact, it's so important.
Or the RPG.
Yeah, it is War of the Land. It is by Gene Wolfe. It's an Egyptian origin for the ghoul. But it's worse than what you think. It ties him into Gene Wolfe's version of Amamet, the Eater of the Dead, who is half hippo, half crocodile, half jackal. Amamet is everything the Egyptians knew that ate you, blended into one very unpleasant god. He's who you get turned over to if your heart weighs more than a feather, because you're full of sin. But it's Gene Wolfe, so it is transcendent just by itself, and I definitely recommend it.
I'd love to hear what you think about the ghoul as a transgressive source of humor in role-playing and literature, because that's kind of, I don't know if I'm the only one that sees it that way. I can't believe that's the case. That's right. Brian McNabb.
Well, they spend all that time laughing.
Yeah. So what does a weep sound like? Does it sound like Beaker from the Muppets, or is it something different?
It's a creepier Beaker.
I recently heard a recording of a baby hyena.
Okay.
Find that and you'll realize what meeping is. It's okay. And that laughing, the meeping sounds. Yeah. That I think it's basically playing on hyenas, which are the ultimate eaters of the dead.
Yeah.
I've actually thought about this. Not proud of that.
Does anyone have any thoughts on the dark comedy or transgressive comedy of the Ghoul, since that's the question?
Well, I just happened to be glancing at this printout from DreamQuest, and Randolph Carter is talking about how his vanished friend Richard Pickman once introduced him to a ghoul, and he knew well their kind. Canine faces and slumping forms and unmentionable idiosyncrasies. Now, I wonder what those could have been. Canines like to lick themselves in different places. Could ghouls be, could Lovecraft be sliding?
Given Lovecraft's disdain for dogs, yeah. You can just imagine.
Well, there is sort of this element of humor that's just built into the ghoul. I think that in Pickman's model, you know, you actually have a painting of ghouls laughing at a guidebook.
Yes. A scene in an unknown vault, where scores of the beasts crowded around one who held a well-known Boston guidebook and was evidently reading aloud. All were pointing to a certain passage, and every face seemed so distorted with epileptic and reverberant laughter that I almost thought I heard the fiendish echoes. The title of the picture was Holmes, Lowell, and Longfellow Lie Buried in Mount Auburn, which, I mean, it's... If Lovecraft literally does it, is it still transgressive to say the ghoul is funny? I feel like one of the reasons that you can get away with a funny ghoul in a way that you can't a funny Biaki is that human connection that we've been talking about. The ghouls partake of humanity either solely nutritionally or personally as well. And I feel like that connection to humanity means they can laugh and they can have a sense of humor. Dracula's kind of a stiff, but there are vampires that crack wise, certainly Buffy is full of them. But the ghoul, I think again, because of that hyena connection, the laughing is baked into the core of it. I don't know if it's as core as necrophagy, but I think if you hear something laughing in a graveyard, odds are it's gonna be a ghoul. It's not just not gonna be Igor, who just thought of something hilarious that happened back at the castle.
According to Randolph Carter, ghouls also legitimate.
Yes.
And in 1930s, if not 1920s, Pulp Fiction, gibbering was something insane people did, or creatures did. I don't know that it came from Lovecraft necessarily. And I assume apes gibbered too, because I think that's an ape sound, but they meet and they gibbered and they laughed, and they could communicate, but they apparently communicated by meeping more than gibbering.
Who doesn't? Do we have another question? Yeah, in the blue hair.
So how did ghouls make the jump to being like dominated by vampires? Because they've sort of been blended together that a vampire can make a ghoul.
The question is about ghouls and vampires, and where did the vampire's assistant ghoul or servant ghoul or slave ghoul come from? Does anyone have any thoughts on that? I, for my sins, know a great deal about vampire ghouls, but... all right. Fundamentally, you have a structural problem with vampires, which is that they can't run around and do stuff by day. Dracula came, of course, but Dracula's special. And so the vampire sidekick has been named a ghoul going back, I think, you know, it's after Dracula, but it's early enough in the 20th century.
Vampire the Masquerade.
Pardon me? Well, yes, Vampire the Masquerade, but it predates Vampire the Masquerade, trust me. And so I believe that is a parallel evolution of the concept of ghoul as someone who is obsessed with death, which is a term, a drift of the word ghoul from, you know, the ghoul, the monster, is the first use of the word ghoul because that comes out of Arabian folklore. And then ghoulish, the adjective, which is someone who's like a ghoul, and then someone who's super ghoulish is called a ghoul even if they're not actually a monster. They are just obsessed with death. And the notion that the vampire sidekick would necessarily be, you know, super thanatophilic, drove people to call them ghouls. I don't think that when Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough describes Saint Germain's servant Roger as a ghoul, that she for a second thought about Lovecraft. I think she's working from an earlier tradition of vampires who have sidekicks that, you know, do all the daytime domestic stuff. And Roger the Ghoul, I believe, does eat dead people, but he does it in a very decorous, civilized way because he's Saint Germain's sidekick.
Well, the human ghoul isn't necessarily always obsessed with death. Sometimes they just traffic in corpses.
Yeah, right.
You know, so that's not, I mean, you could call it an obsession. There's other ways to make a living, but really they're profiting off of the availability of corpses that they're willing to take them up and resell them.
Ghoul is a synonym for body snatcher.
Yeah.
Again, goes, I think, back to the 19th century, if not before.
I mean, it makes sense because vampires only drink blood, and the ghouls only eat the body. So
it's like Jack Spratt and his wife.
Nice.
Yeah, in the front.
So, since you're on the topic of sort of ghouls and other kinds of undead, how would you, mostly from an RPG perspective, distinguish between ghouls and ghasts, which are kind of a cousin of ghouls?
Oscar?
Ghouls are, my interpretation, because again, none of these creatures are real. Ghouls are creatures that, you know, live near corpses. These are creatures that have very close ties to humans. They could have been human. They intermingled. They could have evolved from humans. Ghasts are a separate offshoot race. In the mythology, they mostly live in the dreamlands. They're not really in the waking world too much. These are almost, you could either take it as the purest form of ghouls and the other ghouls are lesser ghouls, or the highest evolution of a ghoul to a being that is no longer truly tied to humanity. They've kind of ascended past that, or descended from that, depending on how you're going to look at it. If humans were ghasts, chimpanzees would be ghouls. There's a connection, there's almost a kinship, but they are related, but two distinct things at this point.
I think that to pull it into the etymological or the taxonomical, the ghast ghoul differential is an artifact of Gary Gygax.
Yes.
Gary has goblins and hobgoblins. You know, there's a monster and there's the tougher version of the monster.
And then bugbear.
And then the bugbear, right. And when Lovecraft uses the word ghast in Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, you don't get a lot of description of the ghast. It's just, oh, there's ghasts over there, basically. There's not a ton of data. But Gygax sees that and says, oh, that's another thing. That will be the name for my hobgoblin of ghouls. And so the connection, I believe, is pretty much entirely artificial through Gygax saying, I need a tougher ghoul. Whether or not you can, I mean, ghouls and ghasts both live in the dreamlands. They're both, you know, awful, I'm sure. You can imagine any number of other connections or other differentiations. The ghast as super ghoul is sort of there with us now forever. But you could certainly imagine that a ghast is, you know, a ghoul but more ghost as opposed to a ghoul but more werewolf or mummy or whatever. The ghasts are like a spectral ghoul, and so you pull back your genie ghoul from Arabian folklore. I feel like ghasts are really yours to play with. Knock yourself out. In the back, yep.
So, hearing all your descriptions of the different ghouls brings to mind Clive Barker's The Ball, particularly the film, you know, city underneath the graveyard, the changeling aspect, the hanging of the dead, the joviality and stuff. Do you know if Barker spoke specifically about maybe his influence from that, and kind of your thoughts on whether that's a ghoul society?
Anyone have any knowledge on Nightbreed?
No. It would be opinion, but real.
I mean, there is. It is absolutely certain that Clive Barker had read Lovecraft before he wrote Nightbreed. I think that's, you know, pretty clear. Was he thinking I'm going to blow up the Lovecraftian ghoul? I doubt it. But that's just based on, you know, my impression of Barker and very brief amounts of chat with him, in which he recognizes Lovecraft, but he does not see himself as a Lovecraftian. And so, you know, I think that the parallels are the sort of parallels that a really strong monster leaves and forces creative artists to do. And so if you're writing a vampire novel, whether you are consciously saying, I'm in the tradition of Bram Stoker, you're in the tradition of Bram Stoker. And I feel like the Nightbreed, because of all the qualities that you just gave, are very much in the tradition of Lovecraft, and that Lovecraft's forcible turning of the ghoul from exotic Persian monster that symbolizes xenophobic fear of the other to, oh, ghouls are always with us. They're in our own cemeteries and have been since colonial times, and we're probably part ghoul anyway. I mean, for Lovecraft, that is a remarkable thing to have done, is to take a monster and make it less racist.
If he realized that, he probably would make corrections.
No, no, he was not a correction guy. He just moved on. Yeah.
While there's no real direct connection between the Arabic mythology ghoul and cannibalism and the sort of ghoul that became now, when you look through sort of worldwide mythology, there does seem to be a connection between this sort of like stranger off in the distance who transforms or has illusions and cannibalism. Is there, even though Lovecraft sort of came up with this not entirely whole plot but through bad translations, do you think there is something inherent in that?
I think the cannibalism is core, or anthropophagy, because they're not people, but man-eating is core to the original Arabic ghoul. It used to be, Richard Burton, in his notes to the Arabian Nights, says that ghoul comes from the Arabic word to seize, and modern Arab etymologists say it comes from the word to kill. So the part where ghouls kill you is pretty much baked into the core, and that they eat you is also assumed similar to the ogre. The eating of the dead is what Lovecraft brings out of Galland and Beckford. So the cannibal monster off in the distance that eats you by the side of the road is universal, because guess what? Leaving your hometown was always super dangerous.
So would that make a Picture in the House another Lovecraft ghoul story?
I don't think so.
I would say Cannibal Hillbilly, not ghoul.
Yeah.
Here's where we can sneak back around to George Wetzel. And his great essay, The Cthulhu Mythos, in which he explicitly does say a Picture in the House is part of the evolving ghoul symbology, that the unnatural extension of life by eating dead people becomes the seemingly immortal outsider, becomes the Pikmini ghoul.
The path.
And, he traces it, of course, back to whatever that is in the tomb in Statement of Randolph Carter. And so you have Randolph Carter to the outsider to, or Randolph Carter to Picture in the House to the outsider to Pikmin, and that becomes this sort of arc as Lovecraft builds this myth, over and over and over, in the way that you start by saying, Zeus is the god of thunder, and then you start telling us more stories about it.
Was that an essay? Or?
Yeah, it's the essay, The Cthulhu Mythos. It's been reprinted a lot in different collections of mythos scholarship. It is remarkably underrated by people. I think it is, it was one of the only attempts to do a symbolist reading of Lovecraft ever. And there's a new one now, but it's, I think Wetzel, even people who are basically, as I say, building on Wetzel, don't give Wetzel enough love. Definitely I recommend it. It's in Four Decades of Criticism. I think it's in another one of the collections that's maybe easier to get. Any more questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, is maybe the hound also a ghoul tale? Because, it's going in that direction.
I was just thinking about that.
And they're getting bitten by a monstrous dog.
I had a Wetzel question about to throw to everybody, but I'm glad Wetzel is coming back at us. I think Wetzel also incorporates the hound into that reading, and certainly the combination of funerary ornament, graves, and a hound maybe points us in that direction.
But ironically, I think if there are ghouls in that story, it's the two guys digging up corpses, not the creature that kills them. If anything, the creature that kills them is not a friend of ghouls because it's punishing someone for grave robbery.
Yeah.
And if anything, the hound is an anti-ghoul. It's a defender of the dead.
Or it's protecting its food source.
Yeah, just, there we are.
The argument could be made.
And I will point out that the hound the is the ghastly soul symbol of the corpse-eating cult of Lang. So, pretty good.
Can you tie that back around to the black dog of kind of Irish fairy as well?
I don't know that Lovecraft knew enough about that lore to have been consciously meaning it.
And that actually only pops up in Victorian times. It's not a very old myth. So that's kind of a very new thing. So it doesn't tie back that far. I think in all of the mythology, they will, even as where they're fairy creatures, they're always humanoid. There's always that inherent connection to humanity. If there are no human aspects of a ghoul, then they're just a monster.
In Dream Quest, Randolph Carter is told to impersonate a ghoul in order to continue his journey. He's told to shave his beard, because ghouls don't have one, and to roll in mold, because that will give him the proper skin texture, and to carry his, he'd be naked, carry his clothing as a bundle as if he's carrying a corpse. And so, basically, Randolph Carter, as a human being, is sufficiently similar to a ghoul, he just needs a little bit of work, you know? So, yeah, I think ghouls are basically humanoid.
I think a thread that runs through this is ghouls are humans, but, and then you have the asterisk, and then you just do whatever you want with the asterisk. And then, you know, maybe they're dog-headed humanoids. They're, you know, people who don't, you know, behave according to society's norms. They can change into, you know, various animals, but it seems to always come back to that, at least from what I've seen.
I feel like part of that is because if you're looking for a dog-headed quadruped that eats people, we have the wolf. And the wolf is such a powerful symbol that if you had a monster that was kind of like a wolf, it's just going to get drunk up in wolf. So you may want to, you know, pick nits about the Beast of Gévaudan or whatever, but 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, if you didn't have a humanoid thing that ate people by the side of the road or corpses after Gallant, you'd just have a wolf.
Or hyena.
Or a hyena. Or a jackal. Or the dogs that hang around graveyards in, you know, Mesopotamia in the 19th century.
Or a coyote.
Or a coyote, exactly. And I think, wasn't there, didn't McNaughton also do a sort of a coyote story? I feel like he did. Maybe it was somebody else. No, it was Niskanen that did the coyote sort of mythos with his sandballer stuff. Desperately trying to rescue August Derleth's nonsense. It's somehow scarier if a person-like thing is eating you than if a wolf is eating you.
Right, that's just part of the natural order.
Och
med de orden så var det slut för den här gången. Mitt namn är Henrik Möller, musiken var skapad av Testbild och loggan till podden är gjord av Malmökonstnären Nalle Chinsky. Hej då.